It is 73 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News time, 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Greg Reberg. We're going to resume the interview which began on yesterday's morning show with writer J. Ryan Estrada, who is responsible for a best-selling novel, now available in paperback from Penguin Books, called Kitchens of the Great Midwest. In this very intriguing novel, J. Ryan Estrada is building upon his own background, having grown up in a small town in the Midwest and having long been interested in food and the way in which food figures in our lives as a way in which we can express ourselves and reach out to one another. And he has explored that in this really intriguing novel in which we follow through the course of 8 chapters a woman by the name of Eva Torval. Although as the book begins, she is a newborn, and but we follow her through the course of her life, and through each of the chapters, it is told from the perspective of a different person in whose life Eva Torval figures one way or another. The overarching development of the book is, in a sense, her blossoming into an extraordinarily gifted cook, and we hear all about that in this book. So here is part two of my conversation with writer J. Ryan Estrada, talking about his best-selling novel, also his debut novel, Kitchens of the Great Midwest. One of the things that surprised me about the novel is that because of its title and the fact that certain summaries of it had mentioned things like lutefisk, which is something I'm aware of as a Midwestern Lutheran, and other things, that I expected it to be anchored in a particular place and, in a sense, branded with a certain voice and certain perspective all the way through, that we were going to meet a bunch of nice Lutheran church ladies who all cook lutefisk, but maybe behind the facade are darker or more complex stories, and we go with them through the years or whatever. But I mean, as my imagination raced through what this book might be, that's what I imagined. I never in my wildest dreams imagined that this would be a novel in which the voices, the perspectives, the mood, the atmosphere would be so vividly, bracingly different from chapter to chapter. I wonder, did you feel any sense that you were taking an artistic risk, or maybe a commercial risk is more like it, in creating a book that in a sense springs out of a certain friendly, cozy, prairie home companion kind of world, and yet has other elements that are almost shockingly contrasting to that?
Yeah, I did feel it was risky, because there are people who want all of one of either thing. I mean, most of my friends are writers, well, an awful lot of them are, and most of the writers I knew when I was developing my skills as a novelist were small press writers who tend to write pretty experimental stuff. And they're my influences you know, professionally and personally. Yet at the same time, I'm from Minnesota. I grew up listening to Prairie Home Companion, still listen to it from time to time, and I understand that that's a certain type of Midwestern voice that people are comfortable with. But, you know, to tell you the truth, the only audience I really thought of when writing this book was my mom, and if she would like this book, if she had lived to see it. I mean, I did write for myself. I wrote the book I wanted to exist in the world, because another thing was I didn't see a lot of books presently where this type of Midwesterner was portrayed. I felt like Midwesterners were either being portrayed as overly simplified or, you know. And it's funny, I've gotten some flack from people on the coast about that, you know, about some people ascertained that I was portraying Midwesterners in an unfriendly light. You know, they said, aren't Midwesterners supposed to be like simple down-home country folk? And I said, well, some are, and I think that's part of our self-image, but we're as complex as anybody.
Well, absolutely.
We're just more quiet about it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's maybe in some ways a more subtle or more shielded complexity, but it's absolutely there. And I think you're absolutely right that by and large, the typical writer on either coast or down south tends to think of the Midwest, if they think of it at all, in only the blandest, most simplistic kind of terms, or even bordering on dismissive or derisively. And I so appreciate that that there is real richness. In fact, it's interesting. As I got done reading the book, I sort of felt like we hadn't stayed in the Midwest, although we really do. Geographically, the center of every one of these eight chapters is somewhere in the Midwest, and yet I feel like we, in a literary sense, travel far and wide, which is absolutely wonderful. One of the things that's a really charming facet of chapter one, the chapter called Lutefisk, this is where we primarily meet Ava's father, Lars. And I just smiled to see the name Lars, since I have a great-grandfather who was named Lars, so and other relatives in my Norwegian family. But one of the things I so appreciated was Lars's eagerness to share his love of food with his baby daughter. Can you just say a word to our listeners about what I'm talking about? It's such a charming, endearing moment in this first chapter.
Oh, yeah. He develops a menu for his baby daughter. And thank God he runs it by the doctor at the hospital. Because he would have Eva eating pork shoulder by, I think, 12 weeks.
And carrot cake.
Yeah, exactly. And eating carrot cake at 12 weeks and eating Oso Buco at 12 weeks.
And hummus.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, eating hummus by week two. Yeah. And guacamole. Yeah. And olive tapenade. He has an extremely ambitious dietary schedule for an infant. And the...
And he's written it all out. I mean, he couldn't be more excited. And he thinks he's doing right by his baby daughter.
Yeah, yeah, and the doctor has to tell him, no, I see different versions of this all the time, especially with first children. The new parent wants to share what's important to you with your child, and there'll be time. Yeah, just pump the brakes there, Ace, you know, breast milk and formula for the first few months. Just wait it out, you know.
And I like how this exchange ends. You have the Dr. Latch saying, your daughter is going to be monstrously satisfied with this diet of breast milk and formula. Trust me. Now I'm going to refer you to the most vigilant pediatrician I know. So that's a very Midwestern in terms of conveying great concern without coming right out and saying very much. Ends up inserting a level of complexity and pain, which very quickly sort of disavows us of the notion of what this novel is going to be about, is that before this chapter is done, Lars's wife, Cynthia, is going to essentially run off, without giving away too much of the details, I want to say I really appreciated the way that you portrayed this painful abandonment. And it's painful for those left behind, and we get a sense that it's tremendously painful for Cynthia as well. I wonder if you could just say a word about what you thought about as you constructed this very important element of the story, and in particular, portraying a moment that could be interpreted so differently by different people.
Wow. Yeah, I had a lot on my mind when I wrote this moment. I'd often felt like I'd wanted to write a story or create a situation in this novel where people that loved each other separated, not because they didn't love each other anymore, but because they didn't have a future together. Cynthia felt like what's important for me doesn't have a place here. And I suppose this happens once in a while. You know, it usually doesn't happen. But once in a blue moon, someone who's a parent to a child realizes that they're not cut out for it, that they just don't feel it. They just don't have that inherent attachment to the child or to the work of parenting. And she felt, if that's the case with me, then I'm not any good here. I've got to move on. I would rather not be a parent than be a bad parent. It's something that is very considered by her. I think it's a very well thought out argument on her part. I think a lot of readers will be tempted to view her as selfish, but I don't, you know, and there is a strong element of self-preservation and self-directedness to her decision, but she's not dishonest.
Right. And I so appreciate the way in which you leave us between, for instance, Lars and the character Fiona, his sister-in-law, who are each looking at exactly the same event and interpreting it through very, very different lenses. Fiona is enraged, and Lars is doing the best he can to accept what has happened as charitably as possible. At one point, you say, Lars leaned forward across the counter. What's more selfish, working a job you hate just to come home and be an exhausted, frustrated, unhappy mom, or following your dreams and becoming a successful woman that our daughter could feel proud of? I mean, this is the abandoned husband and father sharing this surprising perspective. I just love the way this novel begins with this intriguing story. Just to touch at least briefly on some of the other places this book takes us, chapter 2 is painful. It's called Chocolate Habanero. And by this point, Ava now lives in Des Moines, and she is 11 years old and very much an outcast, very much misunderstood by most of her peers. And she experiences a nightmare that many elementary students in her position experience, the nightmare of a school bus ride with bullies. Can you just say a word about the way you depicted this situation and the justice which she is ultimately able to exact from those who are tormenting her so brutally?
Yeah, that chapter was a bit of wish fulfillment on my part. I was bullied on the bus as a kid, and I never got back at them. So writing this chapter was my attempt to create that in my own life a little bit, but also work it into the life and skill set of Eva. One of the things I admire most about Eva is that when she gets back at the bullies, it's not through any conventional means. It's through the means that she has at her disposal. You know, she uses her own skill, her own burgeoning skill as a chef and a cook, as a weapon, in a sense, you know, in creating a extremely hot chili oil. You know, she doesn't intend it to be so. Like, she's not growing hot peppers to use specifically as a weapon or as a means of revenge at school. But she comes to understand she could. And, yeah, I was definitely inspired by my own life there. I didn't have any kind of means of revenge. I mean, at one point I got into a fight in sixth grade. But last fight I've ever been in, actually.
Mm. She's describing this situation to her cousin, Randy, who mm-hmm. tries to kind of look out for her, this is how she shares this. Driving with just his left hand, he's just picked her up from school. Randy put his right arm around her shoulder. When his hand touched her back, the strength that had willed back her emotions for the last 7 hours blew away and tears welled up in her eyes. As she repeated what the boys on the bus had called her, she sobbed, and she wasn't even sure why she was crying. She hated those boys and knew that they were stupid, and hence their opinions were baseless, and the impact of their lives on the planet would be measured only in undifferentiated emissions of methane and nitrates. But still, it hurt, and it hurt, and it hurt. I so appreciate the way you speak for everyone who has been bullied and for whom the measured statements of the adults in their lives just mean nothing at that moment.
Yeah.
Don't speak at all to the hurt they've experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. And, and Eva gets quite a bit of it. And I even toned it down somewhat. One of the things that doesn't always get portrayed when, you know, elementary or middle school bullies are portrayed is how severe they are. You know, and I think these bullies are fairly severe still, but it did get a little toned down. And at one point, they were a little worse.
Mm.
And I remember being told things on the bus that we can't repeat on this program. Yeah, and most media portrayals of bullying don't quite get into the creative language that's sometimes used by the bullies. I remember some absolutely just specious, you know, stuff. of course, in my years, people were influenced by, I suppose, Andrew Dice Clay, Eddie Murphy's Raw, Sam Kinison, you know, a lot of, you know, R-rated performers, but the depth in which, you know, bullies will go, it was really shocking to me, and I hadn't read a lot of bullying scenes or seen them portrayed in a way close to what I had experienced, so I thought I'd better write it, even if it's painful to write about and a little tough. I mean, I needed my character to go through some trials. I wanted her to experience some real sadness and conflict and overcome it with skills that she was developing. So hence this, I felt the scene had to exist, but it was not the easiest thing to write.
I'm sure. Well, it's really, really wonderful. In the next chapter, she ends up, that is Ava, ends up visiting another cousin who is a student at Northwestern University in Evanston. This is told from the perspective of the cousin, and they end up Ava has run away from home, feeling so misunderstood by her parents, and not that she doesn't love them, not that she doesn't still feel loved, but she just does not feel understood at all. And again, I think you are speaking so eloquently, so effectively on behalf of lots of young people where that's the situation that they find at home, that they just, after a while, just cannot tolerate that sense of being so misunderstood. Could you just say a word about the interesting world that you create in which there are these places where people go and confront some of the spiciest food on the planet in sort of a competitive atmosphere? I didn't know anything about this. This really exists in the world?
I don't believe so.
Ah.
There are certainly pepper-eating contests. You know, there are such things, but I don't think. But the restaurant is not a real place.
Ah.
This restaurant isn't. Some of the other restaurants in the book are real. Many of them are, but this one I made up. But many people have told me that it could exist, And some people have even tried to convince me that it did. Like, I remember that place. You know, like, oh, well, that's cool. I don't. But I felt like it could exist.
Hmm.
You know, that there is a environment in our culture right now that would create a home for such a place.
Hmm. That's very well put, and I agree. And one of the things I also love about this particular chapter is that when we first meet this cousin of Ava's, well, first, when we first meet her, we might not even realize who exactly she is or what her connection is to our central character of Ava until she enters the picture a little later. But she is, in many ways, a very rough, raw character, intriguing, but not exactly lovable or even likable in the standard sense of the word.
No.
And yet, when her cousin Ava arrives there, in a all but unannounced, having run away from home, her very presence brings out this more tender side to her. And I find that so interesting as well, because I think a lot of times when people create characters, they tend to be created in one dimension, and we don't often see people and the different sides that they can display, and how authentic those contrasting sides can be.
Yeah, I really wanted to challenge this character in a lot of ways, and one of the ways I wanted to challenge her was to challenge her to express her tenderness. And I knew when Eva showed up that would happen. Because this is not an outwardly tender person. I mean, she's going through a lot of pain. You know, she's 19 years old. Her father abandoned her family 5 years before. Her mom's in total denial about it, and she seems at least as mad with her mom as she is with her dad. I mean, what her dad did hurt her, but what her mom does annoys her, you know, troubles her, that her mom does not see the truth of this situation and refuses to acknowledge it. And her brother, Randy, you know, he's battling addiction issues. So she's kind of alone in her family. Eva's one person she connects with. Eva looks up to her, and she realizes she's got an obligation to her young cousin as a role model and as a bulwark of support. So, yeah, I like what having Eva in Brock's life does for Brock. And Brock is also a person who's so infatuated with the tangible. I mean, her relationship with food is that it's fuel for the machine that is her body.
She's a softball player, a scholarship softball player. And
Yeah. And she doesn't think too much about whether or not it tastes good, you know, or where the avocado on her avocado toast is from. You know, she's concerned about the calorie count, the amount that she's eating, how many times a day she's eating. You know, she eats to, you know, fuel her machine. And then Eva comes in, and Eva's got a different point of view on that, a different point of view on a lot of things. You know, there are things that Brock will learn from Eva, and that's a friendship that sustains throughout the book. And I really enjoy it, and I enjoy telling the story at this point where a difference in age by 7 years, or 8 years, Eva's 11 and Brock's 19 at this point. That's a really, really big gap. But, you know, when you're later on, when you're, you know, 25 and 33, it's a little less extreme. And as you see their friendship develop over the course of the book, you see how Eva ends up imparting lessons to Brock. And it's really wonderful to plant the seeds for that here when Eva's in a lot of pain and needs the support of a family member. And she comes to Brock because she loves Brock and can trust her. And, we first met Brock in Chapter 1, really brief scene when Brock's family shows up for Christmas. And Brock, you know, boldly asks to hold the baby Eva, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and I remember Lars thinking something like, well, that's a brash little kid. You know, he had no idea. Yeah, and so that part of Brock's personality was always in her, the really brash assertiveness. But under the under the weight of the pain that she's experiencing, and also being away from home for the first time, you know, in college. Yeah, she, like a lot of people I knew freshman year in college, she's pretty salty. You know, she's outside of her parents' purview for an extended period of time, and going through a lot of fighting a lot of personal demons. And so, yeah, she's pretty salty. And it was fun to integrate that, you know, into the story amongst, you know, I mean, you know, within spitting distance of Lars.
Right, absolutely.
And to say, oh, these two are part of the same family.
Right, part of the same world.
Sure.
Absolutely. Sure. Just to touch fairly briefly on where the rest of this novel takes us, the fourth chapter, called Walleye, is when we meet Will Prager, who ends up dating Ava for a short time when she relocates yet again. So they are high schoolers, and in a sense, both awkward in different ways. And their relationship is so endearing. And one of the things that makes it especially intriguing is that they both have tasted terrible loss since Ava's mother, or the woman she thinks of as her mother, has just died a couple years earlier. And as they share a hug, once they've kind of learned this about each other, you have Will looking at Ava and saying she now looked older, like a woman whose hand he could take and stride into the darkness with, because she was a woman whose darkness matched his own, and they could fix each other without even trying. They wouldn't even have to talk about it. And I'm so intrigued by that last line, because I think it speaks to a hunger that a lot of people have, and maybe especially a lot of boys or men, about wanting life's problems, especially those emotional problems, to be fixed without talking about them.
Yes.
And onward to other arenas as Ava grows up and we meet other characters. And ultimately it culminates in this spectacular, wonderful dinner in which various characters come together in a way that is so exciting and intriguing and moving. And we should say that the book is peppered with recipes, and these are authentic recipes, some of them, in a sense, from your own past.
Yeah. Oh, and a nice verb choice, too, right there. Oh, you did. Yeah, most of these recipes are called from my great-grandmother's cookbook. It's her Lutheran Church cookbook out of Hunter, North Dakota, the 1984 edition. And, yeah, they're all family recipes. You know, my great-grandparents were farmers and raised their children, and their children's children were then raised. My parents were raised on these traditional Midwestern dishes that I think are really typified in this book, things like the peanut butter bars and chicken wild rice hot dish, carrot cake. Yeah, the carrot cake recipe, yeah, in chapter one that you mentioned earlier is from my great-grandmother's cookbook. And yeah, that when telling the story about food set in the Midwest, I really wanted to marry the traditional Midwestern diet, you know, these church cookbooks and farm recipes with what we're experiencing now, you know, the farm-to-table and locavore movements and expansion of our local farmers markets and reintroduction of heritage varietals. Because I think they can be reconciled, and Eva was my attempt to bridge the gap between the early 20th century to mid-20th century Midwestern diet and what we're experiencing now in the 21st century.
Hmm. And I also appreciate the fact that in a couple of different chapters, we have this sense of the competitive nature of preparing food. In one chapter, there's this very elaborate, sophisticated sort of communal meal that occurs between various young adults, all of whom fancy themselves to be very, very good cooks. And right beneath the surface is this sense of competitiveness, especially from the particular woman who participates, and it's from her perspective that we kind of experience this. And then a nice Lutheran woman whose bars continue to win blue ribbons at the local fair, but what it's like for her when she feels that supremacy perhaps slipping away, and when she takes her bars to a very different sort of competition in the big city, where the judging criteria is drastically different from that of that sweet little church basement. That's an interesting facet to the preparation of food that search for approval, that quest for excellence, that can be really, really scary.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was fun to write about, too, in terms of how people create food not just to sustain and to express love, but to express and assert identity. Like, I'm the person that does this. You know, I'm the tomato queen. I'm the pit master. You know, that's a major part of how we in this country develop relationships with food, is coming to identify with certain things. And when I talk about food with people on the road, I sometimes encounter people who say things like, well, I don't cook much, but I'm great at a grill. You know, whenever meat's cooked, I'm in charge of the meat. Or I'm really good at breakfast. You know, people like to focus on certain things if they don't consider themselves omnibus chefs, for lack of a better term. I think they enjoy the identity in the community that comes with having a particular focus. And where we are as a society, with so many things in our life telling us to focus on something, and the internet kind of, if not enforcing, at the very least encouraging a realm in which we're all herded into discrete groups based on what's moving us at that point, whether if it's science fiction movies, you know, hot peppers. There's corners of the internet for every possible realm of taste and interest. And of course that translates to food. Of course people feel like, oh, I'm the hot pepper guy, you know, or I'm the chili woman, you know. And I wanted to get a little bit into that. And also with the dilation of resources and media related to food, everyone thinks they can cook now.
Well, and people have aspirations now in terms of the kind of cooking they do.
Yeah, they didn't have 20 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. It makes for an exciting and sometimes bewildering world. And we dip our toe into that world, certainly, in your wonderful novel. The book, again, is called Kitchens of the Great Midwest, a best-selling novel now available in paperback from Penguin Books and the author J. Ryan Strottle. J. Ryan Strottle, the 60 Minutes has just roared by.
I appreciate you
being so generous with your time, and I congratulate you on a marvelous first novel, and we certainly look forward to all that you write from here on. And thank you again for being part of the morning show.
Well, thank you for the extremely kind and intelligent questions. This was such a pleasure.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. And for part two of today's morning show, here is an interview from the archives of a somewhat similar novel. For the next few minutes on WGTD's morning show, we talk about a most intriguing novel, which is called The Recipe Club, A Tale of Food and Friendship. It's a beautifully crafted and highly imaginative novel written by two women, Andrea Israel and Nancy Garfinkel. Nancy Garfinkel is my guest on this portion of the morning show. And in this intriguing novel, we learn about the friendship of Lily and Val, a passionate friendship which turns turbulent and eventually is interrupted altogether by an extremely painful estrangement. And it is a friendship which eventually is rebuilt. And the story of Lily and Val and their friendship is told through their correspondence, through the letters they write to each other, and eventually the emails which they exchange. And it is also told through the recipes which they share with one another. And in the way they express themselves to one another, and also in the way they share recipes with one another, we learn so much about who they are, about what is important to them at any given moment in time, and we can see the two of them in intriguing ways, growing apart, experiencing life in different ways, and then eventually finding their way back to one another again. Again, this wonderful book is called The Recipe Club, A Tale of Food and Friendship, and it is published by HarperCollins. And co-author Nancy Garfinkel is an award-winning writer, design consultant, and co-author of The Wine Lover's Guide to the Wine Country, The Best of Napa, Sonoma, in Medicino. She lives in Brooklyn, New York, and we have her on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about the Recipe Club. Nancy Garfinkel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for that warm introduction, Greg.
Are you and Andrea Israel friends at all in the way that your two characters, Lily and Val, are friends? I mean, and to what extent does this wonderful book and intriguing story of friendship spring from any real-life friendship between the two of you?
Well, actually, yes, we are good friends. We met cute 11 years ago. I was selling my apartment in Brooklyn, and I decided to sell it myself, so I put an ad in the paper, and she answered the ad and said that she'd come over at a certain hour, and I stepped out on the little balcony, the little Juliet balcony in this cute apartment, and I looked down, and I see her little shining face, or a woman, I didn't know it was her, looking up expectantly at the building, and something came over me. It was like friendship at first sight, and I began singing Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, over the edge of the balcony, and she laughed, and I laughed, and we sort of a friendship was born at that moment. Anyway, she and her partner came upstairs, and they loved the apartment, and they left kind of saying we want to buy it, and my soon-to-be then husband said, you know, they're great, they're really great, let's not sell them the apartment. I said, why? What are you talking about? He said, let's just be friends with them. He's a lawyer, and he was anxious about having a transactional relationship when he just wanted a friendship. I said, oh, you know what, we can do both, and we did. So that's how we met, and we decided that we wanted to write a book that explored the true nature of female friendships, which are so typically complicated and which often last for decades, if not forever. And so we set out to do that, and we wanted to also sort of talk about the underside of female friendship. This, I think, happens with men, by the way, too, but I think that women are somehow more invested in keeping lifelong friendships and working hard to make them happen.
And more disappointed and hurt when they don't work out.
That's probably true. I think, you know, women tend to function at a higher emotional reverberation. So we wanted to sort of explore the true nature of how women interact with each other on a friendship level, you know, that there's envy, that there's competition, jealousy, anger, you know, frustration, admiration, love. And it's a big, big soup of feeling. And we sort of jump in often, you know, with our eyes wide open or half shut and wake up to who the other person is and who we are ourselves. Hmm. And that food is such a big part of women's friendships as well as it being sort of a fundamental and primal human aspect we all need to eat.
Right. Say a word about the maybe mundane matter of how the two of you actually carried out this collaboration. I mean, who was writing what words, and in what way were you logistically able to create this book together?
Yeah, that's a great question. We started out by each taking a character and writing in that character's voice, and we wrote about 200 pages, of which we threw away 150 pages. But at that time, we felt that we understood who each character was, and we sat down together side by side and took these 50 pages, you know, that were left, kind of, and turned it into a book together. And I've had many writing partners in my life, as has Andrea, and we have a very unique, interesting, and, you know, mysterious way of working together, which works for us, which is that we sort of sit together at the computer and we write every word together. So the original draft of where I wrote a character and she wrote a character was soon, you know, subsumed to the joint effort of writing together.
And you mean literally, physically sitting
sitting together at the computer. We take turn. We call it taking turns driving. So somebody will, you know, be typing, and, you know, we speak out loud to each other, and, you know, the person at the computer kind of does the transcription as well as putting in her own thoughts as she writes. And then we sort of gently say, hey, I'll drive. Mm. And then the other person says, there. And it's very special because we seem to be unable to insult each other on a professional level anyway. And, you know, we say, no, that's a really bad idea. And we say, oh, yeah, maybe you're right. Mm. So we just move on.
I am fascinated. I have spoken to, I'm sure, 6 or 7 writing teams, or at least one member of a writing team over the years, probably more than that over the years, and I have never heard any of them describe their collaboration in the way that you just did. I mean, I've
never experienced it. I'll tell you, the book is written, as you described before, in several parts. The first part is the adult emails, where they come together after a long separation. The second part is a cache of found childhood letters and recipes that constitutes the heart of the cookbook. And the third part of the book is a third-person narration. And when we decided that we wanted to use that narrative form, we felt a little anxious and challenged, like, how are we going to do this? Because it's one thing to sort of write something from a specific character's point of view. It's easier than writing a third-person narration together. But somehow it worked, and it worked exactly as I described to you just a minute ago.
Hmm. There are some things that I especially appreciate about this book. One of them is that these letters and emails and so on feel so tremendously authentic. That is, when it is the letters of young Lily and young Val, and I don't even remember those first letters, just how young they are.
They're 10.
Okay. And then, we're taken through their junior high years and high school years and college years. And I feel like you, to whatever extent I can judge something like that, it feels so real. Like this is exactly the way 10-year-old girls would write to one another, or this is the way high schoolers would write to one another.
Thank you.
I wonder, though, how did you achieve that? To whatever extent my compliment is deserved, which I think it is, how did you manage something like that?
Well, I think we both have very good emotional memories. And I have friends from childhood. I have friends. My best friend is someone I met the first day of kindergarten. She remains a kindergarten teacher, actually. I told her she never quite got over meeting me. but Andrea also has childhood friends that are, you know, very dear to her and important to her. And all of us throughout our lives exchanged letters with friends. Both of us did. So, you know, this is before email, and I didn't use the telephone much even when I was growing up. And I wrote letters to friends who were even living locally. It was just our way of connecting with each other. So I had sort of in my bones the experience, as Andrea did, of what it was to be a kid writing a letter to a friend. And, you know, talking about the things that you would talk about, that you don't want to talk about the frustrations with your family or what's going on at school, and, you know, feelings that are on a kid level. And I don't know, we wanted very much to make it feel as authentic as possible. I appreciate your comments. Many people don't believe that this book is not an autobiography. It is in no way an autobiography. In fact, at a book party that we had to launch the book, our remaining parents were there, and we had to apologize to them because everyone was thinking that the parents in this book are really terrible, terrible parents, and our parents are great. So we had to say, you know, Mom, Dad, it's not like that. We love you.
This is also an interesting bit of authenticity, that when we start to see these incredibly close friends begin to grow apart, that also happens in very believable fashion, particularly in the way that one will write to the other and maybe apologize for, I'm sorry I didn't come to your graduation, but you have to understand that, you know, I had this important whatever. And the one person clearly not understanding how much, in fact, they had hurt the other. But in that sense of being so close to someone and yet being able to be so clueless about how your actions are affecting the other or how something you're saying is likely to be received. I also think that is often the way it works in real life, but we're often so unaware of that.
Ain't it the truth? I know. It's kind of wild, really, how in our closest relations, you know, they say you always hurt the one you love. You know, people are like this. People are sort of blind to the people closest to them. And there's also, you know, because we were exploring this, what I call the dark side of friendship, there is, you know, the kind of a passive aggressiveness that can happen between people where they're angry and they don't want to act out their anger directly, and so they behave in, you know, sort of subterranean ways to undercut the other person. And both these characters did things like that. They were both cruel to each other in certain instances, as well as loving each other. And those emotions are, you know, they're not exclusive one of the other, and we carry these complexities around with us in almost all our relationships, I'm afraid.
Absolutely. I do want to make sure we get to talk about this notion of the recipes that are also such an important part of this book. And we should say that not only are, I mean, they will exchange a letter, and then at the end, I'm enclosing this letter, this recipe for lasagna that I think is going to make you feel better, or some kind of wonderful
right.
dessert or whatever. But not only then do we have that recipe itself, but even the way that recipe appears will be very, of course, carefully, specifically chosen. I mean, what kind of paper it appears on, or is it
exactly.
clearly typed, or is it, you know, kind of a young person sort of recipe and all that that implies? Talk for a moment about the attention to detail given
sure.
to these recipes
Thank
in the book.
Thank you for being such a careful, great reader. You're like our ideal audience, Greg.
Hmm.
We wanted this book to be an artifact that one could hold and look at and feel as well as read. And it was an important thing for us to make this kind of an art object. So the book is in four color, and it's highly designed. So each character has a series of sort of specially designed letterhead that goes along with, well, it's not letterhead, it's a recipe design that goes along with her age and the era. So for the childhood letters, there is kind of childish-looking stationery. You know, one looks like it was ripped out of a notebook, you know, with sort of torn edges, and the other is much neater because that child is much neater. And we have child illustrations that were actually done by a 10-year-old.
Huh? Really?
Yeah. And as they get older in their eras, the look of their recipes changes to match that era. So we have a psychedelic one in the 70s. All of the recipes are age and era appropriate. So the recipes that the kids make in childhood are child recipes, like macaroni and cheese or, brownie sundaes, stuff like that, or chocolate icebox cake.
Or first kiss caramel almond kisses.
That was in teenage years.
Oh, okay.
Right. But that's a perfect example of when they sort of get into adolescence, the recipe names change and the recipes themselves change. All of the ingredients, the book is from a culinary point of view, is historically accurate. So we didn't use any ingredients that weren't used in the year that the recipe was exchanged. So you're not going to find arugula in 1961 when we were all eating iceberg.
Hmm.
So it's sort of, we wanted to keep it authentic on that level as well. From a culinary point of view.
So this is not something that is part of your own history and your own friendship. Do you know other people who have exchanged recipes in this way, where this was sort of a lifeline that was part of their friendship?
No, this was really a fictional construct.
Hmm. It works, but it also makes me wonder if there have been friends out there, I mean pairs of friends, who have ever done this the way that Lily and Val have?
Well, you know, I and Andrea certainly have exchanged recipes. Andrea did as a child exchange recipes with a friend, for sure. But as a lifetime commitment to sort of keeping a friendship together, the conceit of the book is that these two characters get together and no matter what comes between them, they exchange a recipe. And in fact, in certain exchanges, they sort of say, I'm very angry at you, but it's my turn for a recipe, so here's a recipe for whatever. And, you know, it's just a way of keeping connected, even though they're furious.
Right. And some of the names are just wonderful, like Rave Reviews Ravioli or Diploma Dip with Veggies and all kinds of fun things here. And it helps bring this book even more alive than it already is. The book, such an interesting tale of friendship and friendship lost and found again, is called The Recipe Club, A Tale of Food and Friendship, published by HarperCollins. Andrea Israel and Nancy Garfinkel, the two authors. Nancy Garfinkel, I thoroughly enjoyed your book and this chance to talk with you about it on the morning show. Very
Thank
best
you
wishes
so
to you.
Thank you so very much. If I could just give you our website, it's www.therecipeclubbook.com.
And Monday on the morning show, you'll hear a conversation with Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, and the president of the Wisconsin State System of Technical Colleges. Tuesday's morning show will...